for the week of March 2nd, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 227, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Marienbad, I'm Michael Giltz.
Now, I'm sure there's some reference to the Oscars having to do with Marienbad, right?
No, to the death of Alain René, the great French film director, the director of Hiroshima Mon Amour, Night and Fog, and the purposefully confusing art house hit last year at Marienbad.
You know what? I completely forgot that he passed away. What was it, last week or over the weekend?
No, he died like hours before the Oscars, like in the morning or whatever, you know, like the night before the morning of the Oscars. You know, it was, you know, very close, just minutes so soon that he couldn't even be included in the memoriam, which, of course, they time how often they fade from one person to another, and they could not work in Alain René, you know, so there you go.
Maybe he'll be in next year's.
No, I don't think he would be. I mean, maybe. I don't know. That's a good question.
So what you're saying is, if you have to pass away and you want to be included in the Oscars in memoriam
section, try to do it at least a week or two in advance.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't know what it is with this show these days, but we're always opening with obits.
Well, people die. Industry's been around for 100 years. People will always be dying. What are you going to do? Yeah. What happened?
Did you like Alain René's work?
No, I did not. Not at all.
You know, the last film I saw of his, I did not like at all. What was it?
Wild Grass.
Wild Grass, yeah.
Yeah, no, that was dreadful. No, I don't care for Hiroshima Mon Amour. Night and Fog is probably his most effective work, a short about the Holocaust, saying we should not forget. It's haunting and upsetting, but it's fairly straightforward. I'm sure I'm a fool for saying that. Last year at Marienbad is just a puzzle. It's for an art house film for people who like their things to be inexplicable. You know, he's an acclaimed director, though, you know, one of the giants of cinema, and many others would strongly disagree with what I've said. But for me, his work didn't speak to me, but certainly he's a major figure in cinema history.
Yes. Well, and I guess they also last night during, and of course, we're going to be talking about the Oscars. There's no doubt they happened last night. But
what else will we talk about?
Well, okay, I guess let's just get straight into it, because we're going to be joined later by Ann Thompson, our resident Oscar expert here in the Sandbox. Of course, she's also an editor at large over at IndieWire, where her blog Thompson on Hollywood makes its home. And she's the host of the popular podcast. There's too many P's in that. The popular podcast, Oscar Talk. And we'll stop by to discuss all things Oscar and, of course, the Spirit Awards. In music news, somebody, I think, is suing somebody else. I'm pretty sure one of them is a record company and the other possibly a musician. I don't know. American Idol has something to do with it. I stopped paying attention to all these lawsuits a long time ago, but Michael will fill us in, I'm sure. We'll also talk about the future of 3D audio, not only in movie theaters, but also in your home and in your headphones. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And the number one movie around the world, according to RentTrack, which covers box office in all the major markets around the world, is Nonstop, the Liam Neeson action film. Most of the headlines said, Liam beats Jesus, because here in North America, Nonstop was opening opposite Son of God, which we'll get to in a few minutes. But it opened to $50 million worldwide. Yet again, bizarrely, late in his career, acclaimed actor, stage and screen star Liam Neeson has turned into an action hero.
Yeah, you really don't want to mess with Liam Neeson. I mean, even Jesus can't beat him.
That's right. And he's also in the number two film around the world, The Lego Movie, $42 million. It's at $330 million worldwide and counting, of course, and going to be counting for a long, long time. Liam Neeson voices Batman in that movie, aren't I right?
No, not Batman. He's the good cop, bad cop.
Oh, right. He's a good cop, bad cop. Forgive me. And he's very funny in that. It's a very funny character. And number three is RoboCop, another $35 million. It's at $187 million worldwide. It needs to double that, I think, in order to be comfortably into the profitable zone.
It's pretty remarkable to me that this film is doing well at all. It did not get very good reviews here in the U.S. Nobody's talking about it here in the U.S. that I know of. But it just goes to show you how important these action movies are in international territories.
Well, it's made $50 million in the U.S. It's still in the top 10, but it's falling hard. It'll drop out of it next week and be off the charts in a week or two. It's a well-known franchise. You know, it did spin off like two sequels and I think a short-lived TV series, if I'm not right.
I don't know about the TV series, but I do know that there were like at least two sequels. You know, I worked with Peter Weller at Creative Artists Agency.
You're such a name dropper.
Well, I mean, come on. I'm dropping the name of Peter Weller. That's not exactly...
Hey, he's a fine actor.
He's a great... Yeah, I enjoyed working with him. That's why I kind of... It's one of those memories that I have fond memories of Peter Weller.
That's right. But it cost $100 million to make, so it's not making a lot of money yet. It definitely needs overseas to make it happen. It's tripled its U.S. box office already overseas, and U.S. is basically done, so it's going to quadruple what it made in North America easily. But that still will not be enough to put it into profitability. We'll see where it ends up.
Do you think we have to explain that Peter Weller was the original RoboCop to our audience? I think they're pretty smart.
No, yeah. They know what's going on. And what they also know is that Son of God has to be Hollywood's dream project. This is found money, to say the least. Son of God opened here in North America. It made $26.5 million. It's still got a few weeks to go before Easter, so it could have good legs, despite horrific reviews by, of course, satanic, atheistic film critics.
That's right, anyway, because if you don't like Son of God, you're obviously, you're going straight to hell.
That's right. And this movie is just pure profit. It was a TV miniseries.
That's right.
It played to huge numbers. It was rebroadcast. It was put out on DVD. It's the best-selling TV-related DVD set of all time, I believe, right?
It is, yes.
Yes. And now they've just recut it and say renamed it, added a few deleted scenes that didn't make it into the much longer miniseries, and said, come see it again. And people flocked to the theaters to pay to see it. And it made $26 million. The studio must just be rubbing their hands with glee.
Well, the studio picked up the film because it was a History Channel production that Mark Burnett, the reality television show producer.
And Roma Downey, his wife and star of Touched by an Angel.
That's right. They produced
it. And the Mother of God.
Okay. I'm not sure.
She plays Mary in the film.
I know. Okay. But in any case, they took it to Fox, and Fox said that they would release it. And
we'd love to release it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether it's an output deal or, a service deal, in which case they'd get like 15% only. I'm not sure. But either way, this is found money for everybody.
I shouldn't mock Fox. It was a savvy deal. I'm not sure I would have jumped on. I would have said, really? I mean, it's already played on TV.
Yeah.
You think just recutting it and renaming it and adding a few deleted scenes is going to get people to go? They did. My mother saw it. She liked it. Oh, well. At number five around the world is Pompeii, another $20 million for the disaster epic. It made $65 million worldwide, and it's going to need every penny of it. At number six, they don't know how to say this at the Oscars, but we do. What's the film, Sperling?
Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug.
That's right, $16 million, still in China. It's at $922 million. Japan is still to come, and we're still crossing our fingers to see if The Hobbit can get to the $1 billion mark.
I can't believe you didn't correct me there and properly say the name.
You did just fine. At number seven, I'm a little surprised, is Mr. Peabody and Sherman, the animated film. It's made $15 million this week. It's at $40 million overseas. Hasn't opened up yet in North America. I wouldn't have thought anyone else in the world knew what this was, but somehow it's making money.
It just goes to show you how in need of family fare the entire world is. It's not just North America. It's not just Latin America. It's not just China.
You mean there are children everywhere?
Apparently. Hey, the world is round, people.
Yeah, exactly.
There's an Oscar reference in there for you.
The Monuments Men is at number eight. It made $13 million. It passes the $100 million mark worldwide. We'll see where it ends up for George Clooney, who had a pretty good night last night since Gravity was a big hit and he got name-checked left and right.
That's true. And he wasn't even there, I don't think.
No, I mean, we would have seen him if he was, wasn't he?
If he was there, he would have been every other shot.
That's right. In this case, though, it was the guy from Warner Brothers.
You mean David Heyman. He's the producer of Gravity.
That was the producer. Okay, yeah. I beg your pardon.
And by the way, the producer of Harry Potter series.
Good for him. And if you'd like to produce a podcast, give us a call.
You know, actually, a little bit of an aside, and no, I'm not name dropping, but when I first moved to Los Angeles, I sent my resume around and he was incredibly kind. He actually called me in and met with me and sat me down and we met for an hour and he talked to me and he stayed in touch with me and he would always respond.
Did he try to sleep with you?
No, he did not. And in fact, he introduced me to the story editor at Warner Brother Pictures, a woman whose name is now escaping me. Tracy Wayne was her name. Her last name, I remember. You know, one day I was in her office and I'm looking around. She's on the phone talking to somebody and I'm looking around at all the posters. And there's this beautiful poster for The Searchers. And I turned to her and I said, wow. When she gets off the phone, I said, Tracy, this is a great poster for The Searchers. And she says, yes, the historian, the archivist here at Warner Brothers found that in the archives and thought I would like it because, you know, of my grandfather. And I said, wait, what? And it's sure enough, Tracy Wayne, the grandfather, the granddaughter of John Wayne.
So this producer, did you go to the same school or what caught his eye about your resume?
I think, you know, and I can't remember exactly how we were introduced, but it was one of those, like, you know, I was sent to him by somebody else. And, you know, it's the way Hollywood works. Somebody else.
Kids, headshots pay off.
That's right.
At number nine around the world is Superchondriac, which is a French comedy. It's written, directed, and starring Danny Boone, who named himself, he spells it differently, but named himself after Daniel Boone, the American Western hero. And he's a French comedian who's been hugely successful in the past decade in both his own films and films by others. I think at one point, a few years ago, he was the highest paid actor or personality in cinema that year in Europe. I mean, he's just been raking in the dough. Here's another big hit for him. Superchondriac opened up at number nine. I didn't quite figure out what it was about, but it's this hit. $11 million it made in France. At number 10 is Frozen, which made $10 million and, more importantly, passed the $1 billion mark as it triumphed at the Oscars, winning two awards. We'll get to that soon. At number 11, 12 Years a Slave, also triumphing at the Oscars. Another $7 million. It's made $140 million worldwide. And this, number 12, Wolf of Wall Street, another $7 million. That's at $365 million. And then you skip down below Three Days to Kill, right along. There's American Hustle at number 15 on the worldwide chart. That made $5 million. It's at $238 million and counting, which brings me to my point. People talk about the Oscars. Hey, will it make money at the box office? How will it do? Well, you look at North America, and it's still got a few movies in the theaters, but they're basically played out.
That's right, yeah.
Frozen is in the top 10. American Hustle is still on the charts, barely. Wolf of Wall Street still on the charts. 12 Years a Slave down there at number 18. But worldwide, five of the top 15 movies got awards at the Oscars. The Hobbit was not a, you know, it was nominated for an Oscar. Four of the other five all had a lot of nominations and a lot of screen time at the Oscars. Two of them triumphed in a big way. Frozen obviously is tapped out. It's a billion-dollar franchise. 12 Years a Slave, however, that's still got a lot of life in it. American Hustle, Wolf of Wall Street. And if you go down farther, there's even Book Thief. That's playing. That got an Oscar nomination. So when you talk about the success of the Oscars and how it can power box office, the story certainly does not begin in North America any more than the overall story for a film's success does. It matters worldwide, and the Oscars can absolutely power these movies to a lot more box office down the road in the other countries.
You know, that's actually why the Academy Awards was started. It was started as a way to promote movies and movie going. So
to overseas?
No, just in general.
Oh, well, of course. That's why all awards exist.
Right. Well, and speaking of films that
They don't need a chicken dinner.
No, they don't. Speaking of films that have played themselves out and yet are still making money, this weekend, Anchorman 2, the R-rated extended supercut, the supersized cut, made $1.3 million. And it just so happens I ran into one of the heads of Paramount over the weekend at Starbucks, no less, and was talking to him about this and about the release. And he said, you know, they pretty much broke even. It was an experiment. They were just going to try it and see if it worked. And, you know, they're trying stuff. You know, he agreed with us that it was an experiment that helped market the Blu-ray and DVD.
Right.
At a time.
Right, exactly.
When, yeah. So it was a win-win for them. They didn't spend any marketing dollars on it at all. And it raised the visibility.
They'd already
of the
done
film.
The cut for the film for the DVD release.
Exactly.
So they already had the new cut. And it's so easy digitally to put things back out again, isn't it? They do have to pay a fee still. It's not free.
It's not free. However, most virtual print fee deals, if you re-release a movie within 6 months of its original release, you don't have to pay the virtual print fee to the exhibitor.
Ah, so that was free.
That was free, yes. But getting it there, the actual physical distribution may not have been free, obviously.
Right. But it's nominal.
Yes, correct.
So they would always be sending hard drives out. They wouldn't just be sending down a digital download.
In this case, they may have actually sent it via satellite because there are enough theaters now with satellite connections where they are delivering a lot of films via satellite.
Well, you know, we'll be getting to a story of yours that you wrote for Celluloid Junkie much later in the show. That's during Inside Baseball.
Yes.
One little stat in that caught my eye, which is a good thing to bring up right now. 87% of the entire world's movie screens have converted to digital projection.
Yes, well, and
87%. Oh my God!
And I believe not, David I Hancock have... of IHS Screen Digest. I believe he contacted me to correct me on that. So
it's not corrected online yet. What's the truth?
The truth is
lower.
It's lower, but I think it's like 83%.
Oh well, still wow, that's kind of amazing. I would not have thought with all the new. I guess all the screens built in the last 10 years are digital, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. If you have a new build and you didn't do it digitally, then you're
an idiot.
Yeah, pretty much.
So it's upwards of 83%. So it's 1 in 6 is still celluloid, but 83% worldwide, that's awfully high, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So about 83% of the cinemas worldwide are digital, but I bet 100% of our people listening to this show actually watch the Oscars.
Yeah, that's true. Now, we watched the Oscars together last night.
Oh, it was adorable. It was like a sleepover.
Yes, except we were on opposite sides of the country.
Thank God. Yes, I'm upstate New York. I didn't have access to a television. You set up your sling box, and I watched the Oscars along with you. I think your remote control abilities through the commercials are pretty good. You know, you got to get it to where you just stop, and it's right. The show begins again. That's when you know you're a real pro. But you were good. You were solid. You went to the triple speed. I thought you were, you were good.
What are you, like, you know, a judge at the Olympics?
Absolutely. But the best judge, of course, is Ann Thompson, and she'll be here to help us and talk about the Oscars, won't she?
Yes, indeed. We are going to be joined by what I like to call our resident Oscar expert, but she's also an author. Ann Thompson, of course, is the editor-at-large over at IndieWire. That's where her blog is, Thompson on Hollywood. We will place a link to that in the show notes. We will also be placing a link to her new book, which publishes on Tuesday, The $11 Billion Year. From Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at the changing Hollywood system. And thank you for joining us.
Oh, I always enjoy this. It's part of my ritual.
Ah, the ritual, of course, includes going to the Oscars.
Which I did last night. I was backstage this year. We get 2 IndieWire tickets, and I got to go last year in the house. So this year, the critic and the managing editor went, and I was backstage. But I get the 1 ticket to the governor's ball.
Oh, okay. Nice. So is there like a big fight over that?
It was funny because Eric Cohen, it was the first time he was coming to the Oscars, and he kept saying, "Can I go to the governor's ball? Can I go to the governor's ball?" And I put in a request and everything. And he kept thinking it was like, you know, somebody would just give him a yes eventually. And I said, "Dude, I'm not giving you my ticket."
That's actually probably more fun than going to the Oscars.
It is. Although if you spend too much time, you know, diligently finishing up your story, because if you're backstage, you're getting all the winners coming through and trying to catch quotes from them and everything. If you spend too much time doing that, by the time you get to the governor's ball, like when I got there, you know, Bruce Dern and Jared Leto and Sandra Bullock and all these people were leaving. And the people who stay are the ones who go back and get their Oscars engraved. The winners who have taken time to go through the press gauntlet. And the best moment was seeing Lupita Nyong'o and Kate Blanchett together, both getting their Oscars engraved.
You know, the first year that I covered the Oscars, I went to the governor's ball, but it took me so long to finish my pieces that by the time I got there, they were cleaning up practically.
Yeah, no, that's the problem. I saw Cheryl Boone Isaacs, and she sort of, it was an interesting conversation, the Academy president. We had the idea that the whole Oscar season went on much, much longer than usual because of the Olympics, about a week longer. And it was an interesting, she was saying that basically one of the reasons there were a whole lot of surprises was because we prognosticators worked it out. You know, we figured out what was going on, you know, and told everybody. So it's an interesting
thing. Well, and the Oscars is big business. I mean, the Academy grossed $134 million last year. They spent almost $100 million in expenses, and $40 million of that was for Oscar-related costs. They've got a kitty now of $385 million, and they're stepping up their acquisitions for museums and archiving and preservation. But they make a lot of money off the Oscars and all the hoopla that surrounds it.
You'd think they'd be able to afford Wi-Fi backstage.
Oh, that's always, every year that's an issue, and I can tell you why that's an issue. It's at the Renaissance Hotel. And they are reluctant, the Renaissance Hotel, to provide any type of convention or event with Wi-Fi service, mainly because they do not have the capacity. And sure enough, Every
you build the capacity.
Every year at the Oscars, it's always an issue.
Well, you build the capacity. That's the whole point if you want to host those people. And of course, this weekend also hosted, like, the César Awards happen in Europe, the Spirit Awards happen, and they get completely overshadowed by the Oscars.
Well, especially since the Spirit, I mean, I would love to see the indies, you know, go for, you know, the alternative choices. Go for Before Midnight, you know, go for Brie Larson. And they didn't, you know. It's still a consensus. It's still a big group of people who go with the mainstream in the end. Maybe they need to lower their, maybe they need to admit that the indie films are even smaller budgeted than they used to be. You know, lower it to $15 million, the cutoff.
Well, you know, I guess this year it was 12 Years a Slave that swept the Spirit Awards. And now, did you attend that? Because it was kind of a rainy...
Yeah, no, yeah. I did. And I enjoyed the show. I thought Patton Oswalt did a great job. But the, it was a little disturbing, you know, that so many of the Oscar winners got to rehearse their speeches.
In years past, Beasts of the Southern Wild won, which did not go on.
Yeah, but then there was the year that The Artist swept, you know,
and
here's this French movie winning the Indie Spirit. I still can't get over that. That was a Harvey job.
Yes,
you know?
Harvey Weinstein. But he did contribute $200 to the pizza fund last night.
The whole Ellen, she was great. I loved all that stuff. The selfie, I loved it.
Did it play well in the room? Because it didn't sound like it. It sounded very mild. I mean, I like her. She's very appealing.
It played well on television. So I wasn't in the room because I was backstage at the in the interview room. So we were watching the television. It played really well on television.
Well, for me, it was, you know, as always, the Oscars is long, boring, and drawn out, and you look at all the things that they could cut. The montages were very poorly done. I thought it was very sloppily directed. The audio kept turning on too soon. It just felt very, the pairing of actors seemed very random, like whatever two people happened to be backstage at the same time, they'd shove them out front to do an award. None of it made sense like it normally does. Like, oh, they had a film, or they connected this or that, you know, it just felt
random. I agree with that. I think what happened when they got this sort of, they came up with this sort of cockamamie heroes theme idea, and it just never worked. It didn't work on paper, and it didn't work in theory, in practice. And I thought that of all the, I loved the songs. I thought Pharrell Williams was superb. And what did John Travolta call Idina Menzel? Adele,
Zipa Lozupa or something? I don't know.
He like totally butchered her name and didn't get
Adele
it right.
Adele Dazeem.
And so much so that like Ellen DeGeneres came back out and re-said her name. Like, oh, that was very nice of Idina Menzel to sing for us. But how would you like to be Pharrell Williams' haberdasher? That's probably the person who's having the best year. All those hats he wears.
Passing the hat with the pizza money. But that all the, I thought the way that she was working it in the audience, she's taking advantage of those people, getting them engaged, getting them to participate, was really fun.
Well, I think also, they're movie stars. So
they were into it.
Yeah. How often can you get all these movie stars on your network and on television for 3.5 hours? Hey, you know what? Get back out in the audience. It's nice that you're on stage, but go stand near Brad Pitt again.
But they didn't need this cockamamie hero theme. And then Bette Midler, who, you know, she did a good job with it and everything, but there was no reason for her to sing that song. It was such a waste of time.
And plus a waste of time. Why do it after the montage? For God's sakes, like, let her do it during the montage. Why did we listen to a flute?
That. Yeah, Last time it was Streisand sang during the montage, and then she had a real emotional, you know, connection to one of the people who had gone.
Marvin Hamlish.
Yeah.
Well, and so we're talking about the In Memoriam montage.
And sang a song that he wrote.
Yes.
You know?
We're talking about the In Memoriam montage, of course, but of course there was a montage for The Wizard of Oz, which made little to no sense. And I thought, wait a second, they're taking time to have Pink, who did a fine job singing.
She did. She did a good job.
But, and she looked, she looked amazing. But you cut off U2's song. You basically have rock stars singing, one of the world's biggest rock bands singing on your show. And you're like, you know what? Just sing like 3/4 of the song and do it acoustic, because that way we don't have to take time getting your instruments out. And then we can cut back to Pink to sing Over the Rainbow. I did not understand at all.
I don't know. I didn't mind that so much because it was a little surprising, and she brought some edge to it, and it's a great song, so it didn't bother me. But
when the show's 3.5 hours long, it's not her performance. It's that, first of all, they did it because it was the 75th anniversary of Wizard of Oz. Fair enough. It's also the 75th anniversary of 1939, widely considered the greatest year in Hollywood history. You could have spent 7 minutes talking about all the movies from 1939, and what better way to do that to
That's
show where we've
idea.
Gone? Because it's Gone with the Wind is the movie that triumphed. Again, 1939, the first woman to win an acting award, playing a slave. Here we are 75 years later. We haven't got that much farther away. She's still winning awards for playing slaves. But at least this film is from the perspective of the slave rather than the master saying, we love our lovable slaves and don't we miss the antebellum South.
And that may be why they didn't do it.
but they would have had Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. They would not have done that political thing, though I'm surprised that Steve McQueen didn't. But they would have had Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and all the other great films, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and the million other great movies from 1939.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, it didn't hang together the way. Actually, I hated Seth MacFarlane. But the musical Oscars went well last time. It was mm-hmm. Seth MacFarlane I objected to. I mean, at least we've come a long way. I mean, Cate Blanchett gave a feminist speech. Ellen was making fun of, having not seen Jonah Hill's part, any male parts for a long time, mm-hmm. all that stuff. It was good.
And it was done in a way, I mean, that Ellen DeGeneres joke was done in a way where if you hadn't seen the movie and you would have been offended by that, you still would not have known what the heck she was talking about. So you still weren't going to be offended. So,
yeah, it was clever.
And, one of the things she said in her monologue was, well, it'll take some time to see whether 12 Years a Slave wins Best Picture or whether you're all racist.
Exactly. I used that in the lead in my article. I mean, it was a brilliant line. It was brilliant.
It was, because it kind of summed up this year's awards. It was like, Gravity would have been a fine choice as
Not
Best Picture.
Not this year.
But because of 12 Years a Slave, it was almost,
But they don't like sci-fi. They don't like that.
No, yeah, but Gravity wasn't going to win.
No,
it wasn't. Even though it won 7, which is an amazing number, and it's very rare that you win that many and you don't go on to win Best Picture. As I said, in the ordinary scheme of things, that would be the Best Picture, but not this year.
I don't know how brilliant her joke was, because, I mean, we've been making that joke since the movie came out. If you give 12 Years a Slave a bad review, you're a racist. I mean, everybody's been making that joke. But I wonder, we didn't see really any effect of the new balloting system. We had the weighted ballot this year. We had people being able to vote for shorts without having to go through the hoopla of attending screenings and signing off and swearing in blood that they'd actually seen them. And I thought maybe we'd see some different, things come up there in those categories and in Best Foreign Film. But I didn't seem like that affected the outcome at all, did it, Anne?
No. I actually think that what happened with the shorts and the foreign is that smaller groups voted for those, that a lot of people didn't see them all, especially this year when they got them all sent to their homes, so they had a bigger volume of stuff to watch. And so that's how you got something relatively arcane, like The Great Beauty winning, or something which is definitely popular with the people in the foreign branch who actually were participating in that. And mm-hmm. With the shorts, Monsieur Hublot, that was a bit of an upset to go against the Disney film.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this. I mean, part of
My point was that since everybody could vote now without having to swear in blood that they'd seen them all,
it sounds like they were honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they just didn't care. When you read the Hollywood Reporter or Variety interviews with people who anonymously say what they're doing, like, yeah, I didn't vote for I didn't bother.
A lot of people told me they didn't vote. It wasn't that they didn't care. It was just that they didn't have time, And my impression is that more people looked at the docs for whatever reason. They had more time for that on some level. Some of those were in pop, they were released, they were in the theaters. I think the trick with the foreign films, maybe an advantage for The Great Beauty, if people did see all 5, was that it was the most recurrent release. You could see it, in theaters.
Yeah.
Well, I want to get to docs in just a second, but I do want to stay on this concept of the Academy members actually watching the films, because there was a lot of, I don't want to say controversy, it's not a controversy, but there was a lot of talk this year about the fact that 12 Years a Slave was the front runner for the Best Picture Oscar, and a lot of the Academy members hadn't actually seen it because they felt, oh, it's such a hard movie to watch, it's very serious, it's about slavery, there's some serious violence in it, and there was radio programs that discussed it and news articles that discussed it. But
I think they were forced in the end, most of them, to see it. They had to.
You got to, right?
You got to see all nine Best Picture nominees. That was part of the issue, too. I say it every single year. I'm going to say it again. Go back to the five. There was one article by Mark Harris in Grantland that was very, very interesting, which was sort of saying, if you were forced to see all nine of the Best Picture contenders, maybe you're not going to see a lot of other things.
That's right.
That, you know, maybe there was a wider range of possibilities before.
That seems bizarre to me. Like, if you only have a list of five, then you'll go off and see lots of crazy things. But if you have a list of nine, you won't see anything else.
I think that's true. I think that's that he was arguing statistically that this was clearly the case. We'll see, you know. But I still think if you go back to five, it just all starts to make sense again. This nine, 10, it just gets out of hand.
That said, the Dallas Buyers Club was included in the Best Picture category.
It may have been in the top five.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And I think it was.
Oh, yeah. A 12 Years a Slave, American Hustle, Dallas Buyers Club, Gravity. And then the last one, I think, is a little up in the air. It could have been anyone,
Captain
you know,
Phillips
might have been.
The beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah. You know, if who knows if it was only five, whether that would have been included. But for the producers who didn't, they knew they did not have a chance of winning Best Picture. But now it kind of helps. They're Academy Award nominated producers who hopefully will find it a little bit easier to make their next film. So
that's not what the Oscars are for.
Well, I agree with that. They would have gotten those acting nominations in any case. You
True.
Know, they would have won.
Oh, I'm
know,
talking about
a
from a producer
nomination.
Yeah, I was talking about more from a producer standpoint.
Nobody
yeah.
cares about the producers.
Well, no, Robbie Brenner works at Relativity. You know, yeah. she's the one. I mean, it was a sort of interesting at the Governor's Ball. You know, you had the Focus Features people sort of celebrating their Dallas Buyers Club wins. And then there was Donna Langley celebrating that, you know, the chairman of Universal. But, you know, they passed. They were going to make the Brad Pitt big budget version and passed on it. They were one of the people that passed on it at a certain point after developing it to hell, you know. And then the people said they could buy back the original script. And that's what they brought back. So all that development money, all that stuff went away and they could afford to bring back just the original and then go forward. And it's a great story. And only $4 million and only $250 for the makeup and hair.
and
who won?
Yes, that's right. The makeup and hair did go to Dallas.
Should have been Club. Bad grandpa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But go ahead. I mean, that to me is a very unusual thing at the Oscars. Usually they go for the big, gaudy, Great Gatsby kind of win.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And Great Gatsby did win two awards for production design and costumes.
Talk about knee-jerk and and pointless wins, right?
Well, these people are good at their craft, and the people in the Academy go for that kind of extravagance usually. That's why I loved it that the hair and makeup for her Dallas Buyers Club won.
Well, what was your favorite win other than that?
You know, I really celebrate John Ridley from the beginning.
Yes.
I really do.
Because,
I mean,
you know,
there was a lot of emotion for Lupita Nyong'o, and I was glad that she won and everything. But I don't know. For some reason, John Ridley really moves me.
Well, because he's been really working not only at screenwriting, but he's also kind of done, I guess he had a show on AMC at one point, like a kind of a Critics Roundtable show.
He's worked very hard. He's got a really good movie that I saw in Toronto. So I interviewed him early on in Toronto. Not only for 12 Years a Slave, which I felt was extraordinary there, but also the Jimi Hendrix movie
yes.
that he did. What is it called? All Is By My Side, something like that. It's really good. He directed it. It's really good. This guy's very talented.
Well, now, you know, nominated for Best Supporting Actor is Barkhad Abdi. I don't know if we'll ever see him again.
The thing that was sad was that he, you know, here he had this big nomination and he didn't get any work.
Yes. I mean, I don't know.
Well, his English isn't great.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. His English, I don't know where his English is at. Lupita Nyong'o, on the other hand, I think probably...
She has a career.
She's
yeah.
got a career ahead of her, and I think this was kind of the knighting of Lupita Nyong'o as, you know, a... Because they could have given it to June Squibb, who did a fine job, a great job in Nebraska. She's 83, 84 years old. It's not like she's going to get many more chances.
No. Neither is Bruce Dern.
Yeah.
Right, it's brutally unfair. But that's what happens every year. Some veteran wins, you say, it's a career win. Other times it's a young prince, they're crowning the new talent. You know, everything makes sense once you look back at it.
You know, you were talking about Donna Langley, and she's the head of Universal. When Alfonso Cuarón won for Best Director for Gravity, I thought he did a great job of thanking two regimes at Warner Brothers, because he
said that was smart. He was right, and but that's how long the movie took to get made. That was his, his point. I thought that was elegantly done.
Yes, yeah. Because you know, what do? Do you thank the people who are there now who probably had nothing to do with your film, or at least didn't, you know?
They executed. They saw it through. They did a great job. They got Warner Brothers ended up with 10 wins because they also had Her, which was financed by Megan Ellison. Yeah. And they also had, because that was great that Spike Jonze won screenplay. And they also had the two Great Gatsby wins. So they were in a good mood. They ran a good campaign.
And yet, American Hustle, all the hoopla.
Sony was unhappy.
Yeah, that all this hoopla that they were nominated for, you know, all these Oscars. Didn't win a single one.
That's a big shutout. That's a record shutout.
It's not a record. I think 11 or 12 is the record.
Have there been movies that were nominated for 11 or 12 that didn't win any? Really?
Yeah, like The Turning Point or something else.
Yes, Turning Point was I think the one in 1977, I want to say. Something like that. I did want to ask you about Best Documentary, because to me, this was a very difficult year because all of the documentaries were great. And I thought The Act of Killing was actually going to win, or The Square. And it was the Hollywood film, the best. It was 20 Feet from Stardom. So about the backup singers. Great film. But I didn't think, socially they would go for that.
Well, if you have to remember, there is gravitas attached to it because it's about the unsung women, you know, who were sidelined, who, you know, never had real careers of their own. And it was sometimes the Oscars are about, you know, who has the best story. So Lupita had the best story. Matthew McConaughey had the best story. Jared Leto had the best story. And in this case, 20 Feet from Stardom, not only did they have the best story, but the distributor Radius was throwing these great women into all of these venues and letting them perform, giving them a new career, which is similar to what happened with Rodriguez and Searching for Sugar Man. So that worked out.
And it was the one feel-good movie in a night of serious, somber fare.
Correct.
You know, The Act of Killing was, I think, way too experimental. I think The Square might have had a chance, but they have a little happy moment when they're talking about 20 Feet from Stardom. And you got one of the best speeches, which was Darlene Love breaking into song.
Incredible.
Well, now, you are also the host of Oscar Talk, I guess it's the award season podcast. Every year I ask you what you plan to do with the show, and what do you plan this year to do? I know that sometimes you take a little break before coming back.
Well, as a matter of fact, funny you should ask, Chris Tapley was a little reluctant to come back this year. He agreed to do it if we pulled back to once a month, and now we've done it for 5 years. And, we started in 2009, and it's been a great run. We're not going to do it anymore.
What?
I'm going to pull it together over at IndieWire with Peter Knecht, and we'll do our own version of it, which is what we were going to do this year if Chris really didn't do it. He does all the Sperling. I mean, it's a lot of work. You produce, you edit, you do the uploading, and you know, he just isn't into it anymore.
We're dear
friends, and there's no rancor at all. And I'm prepared to go on and do it, you know, with Peter Knecht. I loved doing it.
I have no idea about all that work. I have no idea what he's referring to at all.
Well, we wormed with Peter at the Cannes Film Festival, so we know him well.
Yes, good point.
Yeah, no, I think it'll be fun. I think it'll have a similar dynamic.
Mm-hmm. So, Sperling, be nice to me or I could break away at any moment.
That's true. but before you break away, can we at least ask Anne about her book? Because I know that last year at Cannes, I spent probably the first 7 days of Cannes trying to find you somewhere. Like every time I would go out and or go to a screening, I'd be looking for some reason. When I go to a festival, if I don't run into Anne Thompson, I feel like my time there wasn't productive or I didn't do something right, because you are everywhere. And so by like the fifth day, I hadn't seen you, and I thought, seriously, I'm not doing enough if I have not run into Anne yet. So I started asking around, and finally I ran into, I think it was Eugene or Eric Cohn, Eugene Hernandez, and I said, where is Anne? And I was told, oh, she's not here. And I thought, wait, that was not a donkey that just flew by. So why is she not here? Chickens don't have lips. Why? And I was told, oh, she's writing a book. And I thought, okay, well, that's at least a good reason not to be in Cannes.
I was so late. It was due, you know. I was like really, there was no, you know me very well. There's no way I was going to miss Cannes, which is like the high point of my year, if I didn't have to. And I did have to. It was pretty bad. Getting the book done was one of the more Herculean efforts of my life. And as you know, doing a blog is a lot of work. And I think I thought, oh, you know, off season, I'll just pull back from the blog. You don't pull back from the blog.
I can tell you what happens when you do pull back from the blog. And what
it
happens,
suffers.
I can tell you what happens to your traffic if you'd like.
It, yeah. It suffers. Yes. Tell me about it.
Well, so your book covers the 2012 year in movies when about 670 plus movies were released in North America, had a theatrical release, and it's sort of modeled in a way or inspired by William Goldman's book about Broadway, which was called The Season, which he looked through a whole season by looking at each of the shows and their traffic, their journey. So you look at the whole year and a lot of different movies, and you look at the festivals and how everything works, and you also focused in on the Oscar nominees and their path to how they got there. Was that sort of the model for what this book is going to do?
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And I was inspired by William Goldman. I was going to do this book, you know, 15 years ago. I was always going to do this. And finally, the publisher, this wonderful editor, Esther Margolis at HarperCollins, came and, you know, sort of said, go for it. You know, and I dusted off the old proposal and made it work for 2012 and sold them on it. And they liked the idea of having a blog platform to sort of help, you know, get the word out. And I did it, it was extremely interesting to see also the difference between 2012 and 2013 and what some of the trends, you know, sort of applied to both years and to look at one of the things I might like to do, for example, when I did the Oscar race, I figured out sort of 10 moments that, you know, made the difference in the 2012 Oscar race. Well, this year I would like to do the same thing, figure that out, go back and sort of analyze that. That might be fun. But I also recognize how little investment the studios actually have in a lot of the Oscar contenders. That is a big deal.
What do you mean by that?
A lot of them are released by the studios. But if you look at 2009, if you look at 2012 and 2013 and you analyze where the money came from to pay for the movies, you will see that, you know, in each case, the Argo or the Gravity, you know, they were made by Warner Brothers, but and Nebraska was made by Paramount. But Wolf of Wall Street, Red Granite, 12 Years a Slave, New Regency, Bill Pollard, you know, Film 4, distributed by Fox Searchlight. You just go down the line, Dallas Buyers Club, $4 million movie that nobody wanted to make, Universal passed, you know, all that, just figure it out. And you see that there's little tiny micro budget movies in there, these big, big, big tentpoles, and the studios are in the business of tentpoles, not risky ventures. It was difficult for Steven Spielberg to get Lincoln made. That is the truth.
Well, let me ask you this, because you did it for 2012. Obviously, 15 years ago, you weren't saying, I want to write a book about 2012.
Who knew? Who knew what year? You know, it's just the luck of the draw that it turned out to be a pivotal sort of shifting, watershed year.
This was the year of the Hunger Games and John Carter being a bomb and Lincoln, of course, and the Avengers and Life of Pi and Beasts of the Southern Wild springing from Sundance and Argo being the eventual Best Picture winner.
It was a good story. And the Argo story couldn't have been more dramatic, you know, with Ben Affleck not getting nominated for director and going on to win anyway, Best Picture, statistically impossible. You know, it was great. It was a great year to follow.
Did your publisher say, hey, could you do it for 2013 and 2014 and 2015? Or could you do like something like Michael Apted does? Can you revisit it every 7 years? Is it going to be changing all the time? And can we just do a series of these?
I'm never going to write a book again while I'm still doing the blog, and that's final.
I
got to survive here. I got some serious, you know, health spa reservations for later on because I really haven't taken a break. You know, it's been pretty bad.
Well, do you need a publisher these days? I mean, I guess you could have written this on your own and published it on your own.
I have to say that I did need a publisher. There's a great deal that a good publisher, first of all, you need to be edited, not like a blog, right? and you need, I needed to learn how to make a lot of insider jargon accessible to a wider audience. That was a lot of work, you know, sort of explaining everything. And editors need to be there to say, you they don't know what that means. You know, we're used to talking lingo, you know. And then also they're marketing it. They're actually doing a lot. I'm impressed. I hear people complain about this, but I'm pretty gratified by the support I've received.
Well, that's cool. Do you you've got an ebook? Do you have an audiobook version coming out? You know, it's a whole new platform.
I think we have to wait and see how it does. You know, I mean, in the real world, if a book does well, then there's a second printing or there's a paperback or they ship it to different countries. I you know, that all depends on how many people buy the book. We'll see. You know, I don't know.
Well, the book we're speaking of is The $11 Billion Year, From Sundance to the Oscars, An Inside Look at the Changing Hollywood System. It is published March 18th, if I'm...
Well, March 4th is the hardcover pub date, so you can order that right now and get it right away. I think the 17th is the date for the Kindle book, the e-book.
Okay, well, we will place a link to it in our show notes, as well as links to your coverage of the Oscars and Oscar Talk, the podcast, which will apparently be changing. And it's always great to have you here in the Sandbox. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
A pleasure, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks. All right, well, I look forward to reading the book. It'll be interesting to see, you know, I'm sure a lot of it was sharing insight that she's had over the years, but it'll be interesting to see what maybe she learned while doing the book that she didn't know beforehand. Certainly one of them, I guess it's not a big revelation, is that studios are not interested in tiny movies.
Yes, well, and you know, I had intended to have her on the show when her book was published, but for some reason, I thought Anne's book was going to be published in May. I don't know why. Maybe it was, I had Cannes on my mind. I'm not sure why I dropped the ball there, but thankfully we had her on to discuss the Oscars, and I am certainly grateful. It's always great to speak with her, especially around Oscar time.
And it's only a 2-week gap, but I wonder why the ebook comes out 2 weeks later. It's weird.
Yeah, very interesting.
Well, you know, nowadays that with movies coming out on home video, they always come out almost always a week or 2 weeks or a month earlier on digital before they put out the Blu-ray and DVD, because they really want you to buy the digital copy. It's cheaper. They make more money. And I know that the publisher would make more money off the ebook because it's, you know, they don't got to ship it around. It's cheaper.
But, you know, what they'll do, publishers and studios, is they will certainly try and hide all the profit.
That's right. That takes us to music, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, there is a story here about American Idol's company, I guess, 19 Music. They're suing Sony. Ultimately, I've got no idea what this story's about. I'm not even going to try and pretend. I'm just going to say, hey, Michael,
what's the intro?
Oh, yeah, that's what that was. I thought it was
that's
the news.
That's all there for you.
Should I read it and pretend that I actually do know what I'm talking about?
Why not? That's what you usually do.
Okay. Hey, I feel like an anchorman now. You know, words are really important, especially in contracts, Michael. You know that. Record labels have been having a field day reclassifying income based on the wording that benefits them the most, and certainly that is beyond true. For example, an earlier lawsuit had Eminem suing and winning millions. We talked about this because his label had improperly classified the sale of his digital singles and albums. See, the labels, they tell consumers when they're buying a digital song or album or book or TV show or anything digital, you know, the digital movie, that it's just a license. They tell you time and again, you certainly don't own, and I say own with air quotes, you don't own that song the way you think you do. They can pull all sorts of restrictions on it, pull it from you and put restrictions on it. You can't really resell it, that's for sure, and they can take it back at any time, as they did with 1984, the book, if you recall. But then they turn around and they tell the artist, no, it wasn't a license, it was a sale. It was, you know, it was just a straight sale. And why do they do that? Because artists typically get a much higher royalty rate on licensing income than they do from actual sales. So they'll get like 50% of licensing sales or licensing revenue, but only 12% of sales. And, you know, it's like a licensing is usually a one-off usage, like in a movie or a TV show or a commercial. Now, talk about having your cake and eating it too. That's where American Idol comes in. And if I'm not mistaken, that's where this is leading, Michael, right?
That's right. American Idol, of course, is the launching pad for Kelly Clarkson, Carrie Underwood, Kiss Daughtry, Clay Aiken, Phillip Phillips, you name it. And they're one of the biggest success stories in music in the last 12 years. And 19 Recordings is the official parent company for all those Idol launch stars. Now, a lot of them split from 19 as soon as they can. You know, they're obliged to do one or two albums, and they keep them sometimes for management a little bit after that, but they break away when they can. But nonetheless, debut albums and all those singles and album sales linked to Idol come from 19 in partnership with Sony. It's no exaggeration to say they have responsible for tens, if not hundreds of millions of digital singles and albums in North America over the past 12 years. It's a ton of, and I said sales, but of course they're not sales because they're licensing, since so much of this is digital. Because what happens is people watch Idol, then they run to iTunes and they buy the song immediately, and that shoots it up the charts. Now, what happened is 19 is suing Sony, and it's all over this definition of whether it was a sale or it was a license. And of course, Sony says for the consumer, it's a license. For you, it's a sale, because that's where they make more money. But it's not just that. They're suing for $10 million, which doesn't sound like a lot to me. And they're saying that's not the only thing that they've done. They say Sony often subtracts TV advertising from what they're due. You know, they say, oh, you got to pay for this first. They say Sony pretends compilation albums aren't really albums. They're classifying them in a different way. And that, again, goes to what are we selling and what is it actually? They say Sony hasn't paid the money they owe them from last lawsuits that they sued them over and won. And Sony, in response, says that 19 are just being jerks.
Right. Well, that's the way lawsuits work. And you mentioned that 19 says, hey, Sony hasn't paid us. They lost this lawsuit to us, and they still haven't paid us. That's also another way lawsuits work, where, you know, they just kind of hold out and hold out and hold out, and then you have to sue them over the lawsuit you won.
A couple things. This is not a long-term turning point in music or digital sales or anything. This is a blip, because these are old contracts in which they stupidly said you get a lot more percentage of licensing because they only consider licensing for something like the use of a song in a TV show. Now, since they're reclassifying licensing and using it for digital sales, that means future contracts for new up-and-coming acts won't include this.
That's right.
They won't have the same mistake. And older artists, when they renegotiate, they'll say, by the way, about that licensing thing. So this isn't going to be a way for consumers to get in and get the rights they actually deserve. They're still going to have to sue and go to the Supreme Court to say this nonsense that you've licensed that album, that book, that movie, rather than actually bought it, which is what you've done. You're going to have to fight that and win that case in court. Eminem's not going to do our fighting for this, but does raise lots of weird questions. One little weird technical thing. First, they say, oh, that's the compilation album. That's not really an album. And that goes to how you classify what people are actually buying. And one funny little quirk here is that you get a lower rate depending on what people do. You go to iTunes, you want to buy a song, a single from it, like Eminem. Well, sometimes people go and they find the single under Eminem. Other times, they just go to the album where they list like all 18 tracks, and then they buy the one track that is the single. Now, it's identical to what they bought if they bought technically in a separate little category where it's singles and they bought the Eminem single. It's the same song. It's the same length. There's no B-side. But because they clicked on the track in the listings of albums, then the record label turns to the artist and says, yeah, no, they didn't buy your single. They just bought a piece of your album. And therefore, somehow the artist gets less money than they would have if the person had actually just clicked on it over there rather than over here. It sounds like malarkey, and it is malarkey.
Wait, over there rather than over here?
Yeah, it was over there.
As opposed to
over here.
And as opposed to this or that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, crazy digital stuff. It's playing games where you try and reclassify things in clever ways to like screw the artists out of their money.
Well, you know, I think if it ever does get to a legal battle over this whole licensing versus ownership, it'll be important, I think, at that point.
It'll be a big deal.
If that's the case, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, prolific filmmaker Tyler Perry, who was at the Oscars last night. But Tyler Perry and Lionsgate. Yes, he was. He presented.
Was he a presenter?
I think he was.
Oh, I missed him.
Tyler Perry and Lionsgate have not come to terms on a new deal, and the studio will not be renewing their contract with the filmmaker.
My jaw on the floor.
I couldn't believe it either. At the same time, Perry has realized he has no need for an office in LA and is shutting that down. It was set up to handle projects by others that Perry would produce, but he's got his hands full with his own parade of movies and TV shows. With a studio in Atlanta, Perry decided, you know what, the satellite office, it's unnecessary. Perry's The Single Moms Club comes out from Lionsgate on March 14th, and it's not clear if the studio will release future Madea films. I can imagine they probably have a line on that. The Hollywood Reporter says the break was mutual. Both parties had, quote-unquote, evolved. And they couldn't find, quote-unquote, common ground. They also apparently had family attorneys to negotiate. This sounds like a divorce. Big deal, yeah. Big whoop.
It's a very big deal. First of all, the thing about the Madea films is, do they have the rights to it? You know, it's not that they wouldn't want to. Maybe they don't. But I mean, you know, it's like, is he obligated to give it to Lionsgate? That's the question. Or does he have the power to either make a new deal for that individual movies or take them somewhere else en masse? I'm stunned that Lionsgate wouldn't move heaven and earth to do this. And, you know, the idea that they both have evolved and they're not the same company that they were. I'm sorry, Lionsgate, you have the Hunger Games. Yes. But guess what? That's over in two movies. And then where are you? You know, this
well,
is
again,
incredibly...
you have no idea how much he was asking for. And if he was asking too much, it may...
But then they should have said he asked for the moon and we just couldn't afford it. It made no financial sense and we love him and respect him. But at least make clear that you're walking away because he said, I want 99.9% of all profits.
Right. You know, well, and there may be. Some...
They look like idiots right now. I understand. I'm sure he asked for a lot better terms because he's incredibly prolific and incredibly profitable. I doubt he was asking for an idiotic amount, but maybe. Is he going to self-distribute? What surprised me even more in the fact that they couldn't come to new terms was that he hadn't a deal with somebody else lined up, which may speak to your argument that he was asking for such onerous terms that they couldn't make it work financially. He deserves better terms than whatever they had because he was, you know, making money for them hand over fist. So, you know, like you're used to getting 50%. Now you only get 30% or 20%. It's better than zero.
Yeah.
Well, and somebody else is going to make that deal. You should have been with him long ago, making sure he was happy, giving him better terms before you had to, keeping him in house and making sure that you kept his valuable, valuable franchise, which isn't just the Madea films. It's dramas, it's comedies, it's movies, it's TV shows. I would not want to let him get away.
And the him in this case is Tyler Perry, and the studio is Lionsgate. But we're going to move on to Amazon, who has unilaterally lowered the royalty rates for self-published authors selling audiobooks via Audible, the audiobook publisher they themselves own. The substantial lowering of the top royalty also comes along with numerous other changes, all of which Amazon blithely says should spur writers on to more self-promotion, especially the reward for bringing new audiobook customers to Amazon. Members used to get $25 for every new customer. Now they get $50. In other words, don't take for granted a huge royalty rate or this or that incentive, whatever they give you. Want to make more money? Send more people to Amazon. That's the way to do it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. You know, they're like the only game in town. They've got you over a barrel. They can change it wherever they want. Get used to it.
Right. And in this case, a lower royalty rate is a lower royalty rate in perpetuity, right? Or until they change it. But
sure.
It's over all sales, whereas a kind of an activation fee, this $25, or an acquisition fee, this $25 or $50, that's once. That's a one-time payment.
Exactly.
Right. You know, the Marvel superheroes, Michael, are coming to New York City, so they're going to be moving in down the street from you.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, maybe they'll, you know, be in the same building even.
I wouldn't mind hanging out with Peter Parker.
Well, you know, Disney announced a big deal with New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who is going to be playing Spider-Dad, I think. they were tub-thumping its decision to film the Netflix superhero series The Defenders in New York City. We've talked about this series before.
Yep.
You know, it makes sense. The four superheroes in The Defenders are all based in the neighborhood of Hell's Kitchen, where they eat at Gordon Ramsay's restaurants. And Disney said they wanted to be in New York City for authenticity. They predict 60 one-hour episodes, 400 full-time jobs, 3,000 part-time production jobs, thanks in part to a tax break of $4 million. The series begins filming in July with 13 episodes each for Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Iron Fist, and Luke Cage, topped by a miniseries with all of those characters united for, I guess, between 4 and 8 episodes.
Yeah, it's like a miniseries.
Yeah. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's good for New York. Mayor Bill de Blasio was nowhere to be seen. This is like the beginning of the presidential campaign for Andrew Cuomo in 2020.
Right.
He wants to stomp down Bill de Blasio whenever he can. So there's huge battles between the mayor and the governor. The mayor comes up with a great idea. The governor says, oh, yeah, I'll do it first. The governor brings in something for production in New York City. The mayor is not invited to the event. No. You get no credit for this. So those are all the games you got going between the governor and the mayor. You also have the games between New York and L.A. L.A. is having a big drain of production. And this is just one more example of it. You know, they got to be in New York for authenticity. Excuse me. Hell's Kitchen looks nothing like the Hell's Kitchen in the comic books. Hell's Kitchen in the comic books is a down and dirty place. Hell's Kitchen now, I can't afford to live there. Right. So if they want to be authentic, they're going to have to go to, I don't know, Far Rockaway in order to get the look that they want. But
you know the musician DJ Moby?
Of course.
He moved to L.A. and he was in the Los Angeles Times Saturday section, his house, Wolf's Lair, which is what used to be up the street from me. And I always wondered who lived there. And I guess he bought it. And now he lives there. But Moby was talking about why he moved from New York, where he was based for a long, long time, his entire career, to Los Angeles. And he was saying, look, you know, I realized that throughout the 90s and 2000s, all of my friends had to move out of New York because it became too expensive.
I can't even afford the outer boroughs. That's why I'm in upstate New York. Wolf's Lair is what they called his place in L.A.
Yeah, it's like this big castle up in Beechwood Canyon. It's a beautiful place.
It should be the name of Tyler, the Creator's place, because his album is called Wolf. But anyway, moving on.
You know, Michael, actually, this next story pertains specifically to you because snails of the world can breathe easy. You're safe now. Trust me. The DreamWorks animation film Turbo more than doubled its North American grosses, but that still wasn't enough to get the movie to $300 million worldwide. The story of a snail who wants to go fast. Turbo cost what, like $135 million, but it grossed $283 million worldwide. If it had reached $300 million, Michael was going to eat a snail live on the air and or adopt a snail as a pet. Our apologies to Saturday Night Live and that lobster joke, by the way. From saying Turbo would prove profitable, Jeffrey Katzenberg now insists his film faced the most competitive environment for family films he has ever seen. And the franchise will make money someday, he swears it, because Turbo Fast is one of the most popular kid shows on Netflix. DreamWorks Animation fell 6% on this and other news. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I don't know why the stock of DreamWorks Animation would be affected by whether I do or do not eat a snail. I don't quite get that. But
I think it was more that they were taking a write down on the
perhaps right. But it was only a $15 million write down.
Many in Hollywood call that, they call that lunch, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it was an expensive movie. It's launched off a TV series and it had a modest write down. And why that would send the stock down 6%, I don't quite get. That's a day to day malarkey of, I'm using malarkey too much this week. That's a day to day, you know, swing of stock. That's just a point, you know, a movie opens big and so the stock goes up. It's stupid. It's not long term investors. It's dumb people trying to make money from yesterday to today compared to tomorrow. But I love their claim that TurboFast is one of the most popular kids shows on Netflix. Well, first of all, stats and figures on that. So how the heck do you know? And second of all, that's not much of a claim.
Right. Well, and you know, a few more qualifiers, please.
Yeah, exactly.
It's on Netflix. It's a kid's show, animated. Yeah, I mean, come on.
But it's not all bad news for DreamWorks Animation. They do have, this is weird, they have some sort of theme park type attraction coming to London. It's opening near the London Eye. It's called like the Far, Far and Away Adventure. It's for Shrek.
Yeah.
And it opens in the summer of 2015. It's some sort of thing. I don't know what it is. It's 20,000 square feet. It's just like one sort of ride experience type thing. And then there's an area where you can meet people dressed up as the characters from Shrek. It's just a standalone little thing, like one ride that you might see at a theme park. It's like that on its own on the banks of London near the London Eye. It seems weird to me.
That's right, people. You tune into Showbiz Sandbox to hear part of a story and about things.
Well, because they didn't explain it well in the story. I read it in Variety and Hollywood. I couldn't figure out what it was. If they'd explained it better, and I could say it's a roller coaster or it's a show. Or I don't know what it is. So it's kind of odd. And no matter what it is, it's a standalone thing you'd expect to see in a theme park, not just on its own around the corner. Oh, well.
You know, speaking of DreamWorks Animation, you know, it was spun off from DreamWorks. You might recall, which makes the whole thing very confusing. DreamWorks is the live action division, which is a standalone company run by Stacy Snyder and Steven Spielberg. But for how long? Snyder was itchy to leave 2 years ago when Comcast was purchasing NBC Universal, but her contract and various commitments were, you know, kind of too entangling. Now her contract is up in November, and Snyder is in informal talks with Fox about becoming the number two for Jim Giannopoulos. That would mean a much bigger slate and fewer financial constraints for Snyder, who has been reduced to tiny plays like upcoming racing drama Need for Speed, or as I like to call it, the Fast and Furious take, you know, ripoff, and recent flops The Fifth Estate and Vince Vaughn's Delivery Man. Both Snyder and Fox want the deal to happen, so it's only a matter of time. That leaves Spielberg to decide if he wants to hire a new executive or call it a day for the once mighty indie DreamWorks. Remember, founded in 1994, 20 years ago. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Sounds like it's the end of the days for DreamWorks. I mean, she's definitely going to Fox, no question about it. They want her. She wants to go there. It's going to happen. The question is only when and what happens to DreamWorks.
Well, you know, I knew when she was trying to negotiate this kind of taking over universe, she wants to run a studio. That's, I'm trying not to sell
right,
anybody
and,
up the river
and DreamWorks has been so reduced in scale, she can't even get Spielberg's Lincoln made, barely, so it's not a lot of fun.
Yeah, I know some people over at DreamWorks now, and they're constantly saying that Stacey Snyder is complaining that she really wants to run a studio and is good at doing that type of job.
Well, who wouldn't want to run a studio? I want to run a studio.
Well, yeah, but, you know, she's a former studio head. Yeah. You know, J.K. Rowling apparently loves to know what she's doing years in advance. First, she sketched out the entire Harry Potter series on paper before getting down to actually writing them. And now, in a way, she's doing that with her latest series, detective novel starring a former veteran called Cormoran Strike. Because, you know, we all know people named Cormoran Strike. The series launched with The Cuckoo's Calling under the pen name Robert Galbraith. It got very good reviews and low sales. That was until news leaked about the book's real author, and it went on to sell 1.6 million copies, modest by Potter standards, but great by anyone else's. Rowling had already written the second book before the first was published, and it comes out in June. Now she says she has plans for five more, though it's unclear if there will be an overarching plot like there was in Harry Potter, or just what she, you know, just a plot that she wants to do. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a big whoop, I guess. We know there's going to be five more books in this series. It's good to know. I think she's really happy that she got good reviews before people knew who it was that wrote it. She felt like it got a fair shake. And now she gets the, you know, even though she was unhappy about the leaking, she's also glad that, you know, the series is getting, you know, people are reading it. They're enjoying it. And there's going to be seven in all. And I'm looking forward to diving in. I'm going to read the first one. So I'm ready for the second one when it comes out in June. And I'm sure there will be a TV series and or movie based on them any day now.
The movie about legendary rocker Greg Allman has halted production for good, at least for the moment. On the first day of shooting, crew member Sarah Jones was killed after an on-set accident involving a train and a hospital bed placed on the railroad tracks. Accusations are flying back and forth as to whether the crew had permission to film on the tracks and whether proper safety features were followed. William Hurt was set to play the adult Allman, and Tyson Ritter of All-American Rejects was playing the young Greg Allman. The producers say the film will happen, but aren't clear as to when, and various crew members are lawyering up while investigations continue. A funeral for second assistant camera person Sarah Jones was held last week. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, people do not want a fish to be caught when you're making a movie. They don't want an animal to be harmed even briefly. So, you know, a person dying feels really unacceptable, especially when it wasn't in a case where you were trying to do some wildly dangerous stunt and something went wrong and you were taking a risk. This was just shooting a scene in a railroad yard and nothing like that should ever happen. They slapped her name up after the end of the In Memoriam. Like right when Bette Midler finished singing, they flashed up her name on the screen. At least they worked her in. I don't know why it was so last minute. Or why it was done in that way, but at least they acknowledged her, as I think symbolically they should have, because it's a real tragedy.
Now, in an attempt to erase a perceived slight of Christians and some ill will, Paramount is tweaking its marketing campaign for the upcoming film Noah. The head of the National Religious Broadcasters Group came up with the following message, which will be attached to most ads for the film and most media from here on out. It says, quote, "The film is inspired by the story of Noah. While artistic license has been taken, we believe that this film is true to the essence, values, and integrity of a story that is a cornerstone of faith for millions of people worldwide. The biblical story of Noah can be found in the book of Genesis. Well, I'm glad it was a short little blurb that they put on there, not based on true stories, you know, just like
a whole paragraph.
But
they told you where you can find it. Like, yes. You don't know.
What a joke.
It's in this book called the Bible.
Yeah.
And go to the section called Genesis. It's towards the beginning, I think. I'm not sure, but you can look it up. There's probably a table of contents.
In the beginning, there was Paramount Pictures. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. It's idiotic beyond measure. Talk about putting yourself in a corner and feeling you've got to cave and do some ridiculous thing like this. This is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. The story of Noah is about 100 short lines. It's 4 short chapters. You can read it in 10 minutes. Of course, they've added stuff to it. And of course, they didn't intend to distort and pervert the message of the Bible. Well, who would make a movie with a big budget and intend to do that? Hollywood's never going to do that. But the idea that they tell you, by the way, you can find it in Genesis. It's like, if you don't know that, you probably don't have a Bible anyway. But, and they have taken creative license. It is true. They have made some changes. For example, unlike the King James Version and most versions of the Bible, in this film, Noah is not going to be 600 years old when the flood strikes, nor will he live another 350 years after the flood recedes. So no, he won't be almost 1,000 years old at the end of the film. That's one of the creative licenses they took from the book of Genesis and the story of Noah, and I find that literally hard to believe.
You know, I think one of the other licenses they took, I'm pretty sure that Russell Crowe is not Noah in the Bible. I could be wrong.
And of course, they probably won't emphasize the fact that God slaughters all of humanity and every creature in the world. Literally the worst Holocaust in the history of man, kills everything. Every single, you know, we're all descended, not from Adam, we're all descended from Noah.
Because yeah. Well, God wanted a do-over. God wanted a do-over.
Yeah, God did a reboot on Earth. Oh, well. Sorry, Earth.
Now there's the title of our show. Now, I guess that brings us to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Okay, now, we're going to be talking about, an email that was sent in by James Gardner. Full disclosure, I found out James Gardner actually wrote a piece for Celluloid Junkie. My alternative home, and I guess it was on High Frame Rate Cinema, so he wrote in here to Showbiz Sandbox. He is a listener. He's out of Melbourne, Australia.
And we've quoted him before, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Yes. Do you want to read?
I'll read the letter since this is your area. James says, "Hi guys, with the recent developments with Dolby purchasing Do Re Mi, I would like you to bring it up in Inside Baseball. Michael, I think it would be interesting if Sperling explained the situation, and then you do your no bullshit analysis of it."
Oh, he didn't say, he's actually said @pound.
No it's one of the reasons I like listening, he says. Sperling did a good post on his site about this, so Michael, I recommend you read it first. James, I always read everything Sperling writes, just as he always reads everything I write. Right, Sperling?
I'm pretty sure he does. Yes, he's from, you know, he's with Digital in Melbourne, Australia.
You read all the things I write.
Absolutely.
Of course. James Gardner is from Digital in Melbourne, Australia. Thanks for writing in. We certainly were aware of it since Sperling wrote it. We talked about it a few days ago. You were just like overwhelmed with this news. It was stopped everything in their tracks while you covered it. What happened? What went on? Dolby purchased Do Re Mi. I don't know what that is.
Okay, so Do Re Mi, and this gets fairly technical, but I'll try and simplify it. Do Re Mi
it's not technical. It's easy.
Is a digital cinema manufacturer. They make broadcast equipment and digital cinema equipment. And they, very early on, during the digital cinema transformation or conversion, decided to use and make a board, a circuit, if you will, like Intuit, Intel Inside. They made a media block that decodes digital cinema and sends it to the projector. They decided to rely on JPEG 2000, which is the compression.
They chose a standard.
Right. And it's an open standard. And they decided not to do what everybody else in the industry did, which was develop their product around the MPEG format, which is what, you know, iTunes has developed around the MPEG format.
Mm-hmm. So this is a company that provides audio equipment, or what did they provide to movie theaters?
They're basically like, they create, they're like Dell. They sell servers, but they're digital cinema servers where the content is stored and played back to the projector. So they're very secure, very technical. And they have software and hardware that has to pass certain muster that the studios have kind of set the bar very high.
And how much of the market do they have?
60%. They pretty 60%.
Much. 60%. So 60% of all theaters in North America use Do-Re-Mi.
In the world. 60%.
In the world.
In the world. Yes. Because they had such a long lead and such they guessed right. They said, we'll develop around JPEG 2000. The industry went JPEG 2000. They won.
Why did the industry go?
I think the industry did not want to standardize around MPEG for a number of reasons. One, I think they had to pay a license fee. Two, I think they wanted something that was different than could be found in the home.
And so now Dolby, were they a competitor with Do-Re-Mi or were they not a player in this particular market? Because we know Dolby, in my head, Dolby provides speakers and audio stuff to movie theaters.
Right, and into the home and, you know, audio compression.
Oh, yeah, but yes. We're talking about movie theaters right now for the moment.
And so what Dolby did was they made servers just like Do-Re-Mi. They made their own media block, the part that decrypts the secure content. And then they stopped making their own media block, and they did not fare very well. They were like the number four provider here in the United States, behind Do-Re-Mi, behind Sony, behind GDC. So these are all
So they couldn't break into the market, so they bought the number one player in this market.
Right, which you'd think, okay, so they're buying market share. Yes, they are. They are. But here's the thing. The digital cinema conversion is, for the most part, over, as we've mentioned before. You know, between 80 and 90% of the world is now digital. So why would you buy a manufacturer for a product that most people, only 10% of the market, is actually going to need within the next 5 years?
Right, so they've already bought their equipment, so now that they have it, it's only until it wears out or they upgrade or something, which they don't want to do a lot. So Do-Re-Mi has been the market standard, and they're sort of at a peak in market share and revenue and all that, but that's it's plateauing right now. This is their peak moment.
Right.
Everybody already bought it. Now, maybe 2 years now, one will buy it, and then the next year, another 10% will buy it. But basically, the churn is now for replacing product that they already have rather than buying something from scratch and installing it.
Right. And if they're buying it new, it's probably for a brand new theater. Now, and so everybody knew that this sales cliff was coming. You know, all these manufacturers knew, once we hit 90%, it's going to be 7-10 years before we see any sales of any consequence. But what Dolby is doing here, and this is why, and I wrote this piece for Celluloid Junkie, which got a lot of play last week, about why this acquisition makes sense for Dolby, not only because they're buying market share and getting a foot in the door with exhibitors where they had lost it, which is with digital cinema servers.
And buying at peak, though. So they're buying it when it's going to be its most expensive. Why are they buying it now? Why are they acting now? And it has nothing to do with cinema, does it?
Well, not really. Yes and no. Here's the thing. They have this audio format called Atmos. This is 3D audio.
Like atmosphere.
Yes. It's object-oriented. So most of the time, you have channel-based audio, 5.1. You have five channels of surround sound, and it's either in the left or the right or the center or behind your head to the left or behind your head to the right. That's 5.1 audio. It's, you know, the sound is directed to a specific speaker at a specific volume. Mm-hmm. What Atmos is, and what Barco Oro's 11.1 is object-based. So they have a 7.1 soundtrack, but then they pull certain objects out, and they say it's not only left, right, center, but it's actually within the space, it's got a Z-axis. So it's like 3D audio. They're actually placing it not only left and right, but also forward and backward.
Is it that they're also adding a lot of speakers in a movie theater, or what is it? Well, is it just that they make it sound like 30% comes out of one channel and 70% comes out of another, and therefore it sounds like it's sort of almost a third of the way between one and the other? Or is it that they've added speakers overhead and 100 speakers rather than just, you know, 10?
Well, and that's where there's this battle going on right now between MDA, multi-dimensional audio, which is this technology that DTS... DTS, they have...
Right, different companies have their own formats.
Right. However, here's the thing. DTS and the competitor to Dolby, this Barco, they are standardizing around an open format. Nobody has to pay for it. So theater owners don't have to pay.
And Dolby doesn't make as much money.
And the studios don't have to pay a license fee to use and create content with that format. So, of course, the studios like it. And they have requested that any object-based or immersive audio, 3D audio, be created and distributed in an open format. Now, how that gets played back, if there's any special sauce or special algorithm or special technology that you want to play.
Basically, they want to mix their movies once and be done with it. And if you want to use Barco or DTS or Dolby to play it back and get whatever extra oomph you can out of it, knock yourselves out. But we don't want to have to remaster our movie for every stupid audio system that's out there. So make it open source and we only have to do it once. And Dolby says, we don't want that.
That's right, because they have this proprietary system that is called Atmos, which they make money off of. They basically make licensing fees for studios using that
so
technology.
So they have bought Do Re Mi, and their play is not really to get the fees from the studios. They don't really care about that too much. Where they make most of their money is in home electronics. And I remember in the 70s when you'd get Dolby Digital, that little logo on your stereo system. Ooh, it had Dolby Digital, Dolby Digital stereo headphones, Dolby Digital cassette player, Dolby Digital CD. You looked for that. Everything had that Dolby Digital slap on it, which you saw when you went to movie theaters. So you've got the branding when you go to see a movie. Oh, it's in Dolby Digital. And then you go to the stereo store to buy your stereo for your home or your car or whatever, and you see the Dolby Digital symbol and you say, I'll buy that one. That's the cool Dolby Digital. You buy it and they make money off the chip that they've placed in that stereo, and that's where the real money is.
That is absolutely correct, and that is exactly where you summed up something that I probably would have spent far too much time trying to explain. They want to, and this is Dolby wants to make sure that they are in cinemas. And one way to make sure that Atmos is in cinemas is to buy the server company that has equipment in 60% of the cinemas.
Guess what? You're going to be using Atmos.
Yes, correct. And by the way, it could be a little bit more difficult for any competitor like Barco with its 11.1 3D audio, Oro. It might be more difficult for them to, you know, install that technology in future servers or even in existing servers in the marketplace today.
So they'll play it back. I mean, if something is done in Barco, it'll play off the Do Re Mi system, but just not as well, or just the theater won't even have it. They have, our screens are in DTS, or they're in Atmos, or they're in Barco, and that's it.
Right. Well, that's what they're trying to get to. And really, Dolby is an expert at marketing. They know that if you see Dolby in movie theaters.
And I did. You saw that in the 70s. That was what you saw.
Right.
You see it in the ads. You see it in the ads. You know, right. This screen on this theater has DTS, or this screen in theater had Dolby Digital. This screen is THX. You see those branding, and that you see that every time you look at the movie ads, that starts to stick in your brain. Then you go to buy the stereo equipment. Guess what you're looking for?
Right. And full disclosure, I used to work for DTS, and every time I would tell people that, most of the people, and ironically, a lot of people in the industry would say, so like Dolby, right? You're working for Dolby? and because they were so good at marketing. They're so good at getting their technology adopted that rather than go to the studios and ask them to adopt Atmos, and rather than go to exhibitors and ask them to adopt Atmos, which they did, by the way, they went straight to the creatives. And
they also went to James Cameron.
Right. And to Ang Lee and to all of these influential creatives and said, don't you want your audio to sound this good? Now, to answer your question, do you need more speakers? Last week, I saw a demonstration of MDA audio, so the open format, that was run on 43 speakers or 53 speakers, something like that.
What would most theaters have right now?
Most speakers have speakers.
Most theaters.
I don't know how many speakers it is, but they have left, center, right behind the screen, and then they have surround sounds on the sidewall and in the back.
Maybe like 10 or something like that, or 12.
Yeah, exactly.
And we all remember that time when you first saw surround sound or 5.1 or 7.1. You saw a movie and a helicopter went over your head and you felt like, oh my God, it's behind me. That was exciting.
Right.
That was new.
That was Jurassic Park in 1993. That was the first film that had it.
All right. When you saw this demo, what was it like?
Well, you know, they started with 43 channels and then they dropped channels. 43 speakers. And they started dropping speakers to show that it doesn't matter. The setup doesn't matter. You can do this with your existing 7.1 setup and it will still sound the same. And it took me like three or four passes before I realized, because they kept showing the same content over and over again, taking speakers away. And I kept going, I don't hear a difference. Okay, the first one sounded really, really good, but the second one didn't sound bad. And the third one didn't sound bad. I mean, maybe the fourth one sounded a little less, loud.
Oomphy.
Yeah, and then I realized, that's the whole point. That's what they're trying to say, is that it doesn't, you can have it as you know, grandiose as you want with all these speakers overhead. And it is pretty remarkable how they can really pinpoint down to the seat where where a sound plays. Or you could just have what exists today. Now, I spoke with the head of DTS right after this demonstration, and I asked him point blank. I said, listen, Dolby, DTS, if you're not going to make any money by licensing this technology into the cinema, which is what you're proposing, where do you make your money? You're going to want to make it somewhere.
They make it in the home.
He said point blank, it's in the home, it's in mobile. He said, you know, it's very difficult to control where speakers are placed in somebody's home. In everybody's home, it's going to be different. You know what? Where we can control...
Headphones.
Bingo. He said, we know where the two speakers are when you're listening to your iPhone or with headphones.
But I've never noticed any audio system as such proprietary thing for smartphones or... I mean, that's all it is now, right? It's smartphones.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So do we have... Atmos or DTS on smartphones?
Not yet. So DTS has this Headphone X, I believe it's called. And I've actually heard some demonstrations about 7 years ago. Starting 7 years ago, I started hearing these demonstrations. They call it psychoacoustics.
Yeah. But this is the problem. We're talking about people listening to MP3s on their headphones off their smartphone. What are you listening? I mean, I've heard that stuff and it sounds very cool, but how's this going to work off our crappy MP3 sound files?
Well, that's precisely what I was listening to 7 years ago. They were playing MP3 sound files through this filter that...
But a wave is a... Yeah, I mean, it's what's the sampling rate? How big a digital file was it? Is this real world or is it ideal?
Well, I think 7 years ago, it was not real world. You know, it was ideal. More and more, the examples I'm hearing, as you turn your head, the sound changes. It's remarkable. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's all psychoacoustics. It's, in other words, it's not really...
It's not where the speaker is. It's how they make you think the speaker
exactly.
is.
Exactly. It's not exactly how the sound is being portrayed to you necessarily. It's how they make you believe the sound is being portrayed to you. And it's...
What does Neil Young think of all this?
I'm sure he hates all of it.
No, I shouldn't. Not necessarily. Well, it's movies. It's not. So that bottom line is Dolby bought their way into a market that they had failed in. They bought a majority stake in a market in the movie theaters that they did not control. Has to get approved, and it will be sort of a close to a monopoly, 60% of worldwide. That's a massive market share.
Right.
And they've already got all these other developments. And the play down the road is really not being in movie theaters, but using that to brand your product so people will want Atmos or DTS or whatever it is in their home system, be it for headphones that are DTS compatible or Atmos compatible or Barco compatible, because you want your Beats headphones that have Atmos so that you can get even cooler sound when you listen to music at home.
That's absolutely correct. You have summed it up perfectly. You are hired.
All right. Are they going to win? Who's going to win?
Well, you know, Dolby is really, really good at going directly to the creatives and getting the creatives like Ang Lee or
Dr. Dre,
James Cameron and Dr. Dre's of the world to then turn to their record labels or to the studio heads and say, I want Dolby surround sound. I want Dolby Digital. I want Atmos.
I want 3D.
And the studios hate that. They hate the fact that like Dolby does that because then what are you going to say no to Steven Spielberg?
Uh-uh.
So there you go. So they hate that. And every chance they get, they try and ding Dolby a little. And that's what they did when they kind of said, oh, we have to rely on an open standard so that we can mix once.
What they're really saying was, screw you, Dolby.
Pretty much, yeah. It was a clear shot at Dolby. Everybody kind of knew that, including Dolby, by the way.
Yes, they did. And our listeners know we love it when they review our show, don't they, Sperling?
Yes. In fact, we love it. We know you're listening. In fact, we know that. And
we can see. We're watching you, just like the NSA.
Okay, I wouldn't go that far, but, you know, in any case, look, we appreciate the fact that you listen to us. And we love it when you write to us and you call us on our voicemail. We have voicemail.
How do they do it?
888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or you can write to us the way James did. You can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. It's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And really, I know some of these shows are long. I know we sometimes get really technical like we just did with digital cinema. But we really appreciate you listening and subscribing to the show in iTunes and the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher or wherever they give podcasts away for free. That's where you can find us. And in fact, you can rate and review the show in any one of those Yeah, you can. And it does help us out when you give us those 5-star reviews. Was that subliminal enough, Michael?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Just check. It does help us out. I mean, let's face it. When people rate the show and review the show in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher, it helps us out. Now, links to all of Ann Thompson's work, and I'd really like to thank her for joining us today to talk about the Oscars, the Spirit Awards, and her book, of course, The $11 Billion Year from Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at the changing Hollywood system. We'll place links to all of Ann Thompson's work, including her Twitter account, including her blog. We'll place that in our show notes, and that's where you can find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. That's also where you'll find all those links to contact us or to subscribe to the show. It's where you can find ways to follow us on Twitter. Our username is @ShowbizSandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, where if you search for, I guess it's just facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week, it's a little different. What is it this week?
Tyler Perry is moneyinthebank.com.
Well, you know, if you find it difficult to read any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry on that particular website, try michaelgiltz.com, try thehuffingtonpost.com, and some of the other outlets that Michael writes for, like bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.